From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, slavery in America from an African point of view. Filmmaker Haile Gerima grew up in Ethiopia, but he didn't learn about slavery until he moved to the United States. We'll talk about his new film Sankofa, which begins with the deportation of Africans to America. Also, we talked to Frank Rich about his years as the most powerful theater critic in America. After 13 years reviewing theater for the New York Times, he's now writing an op-ed column for the paper. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by British soprano saxophonist Lowell Coxhill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Transportation Department has turned down an attempt by a group headed by Frank Lorenzo to get a new airline off the ground. The firm, named ATX, says it will appeal the decision. The government says Lorenzo's aviation record fails to show he has a sufficient commitment to safety or legal requirements. Lorenzo once headed Continental and Eastern Airlines, both of which had serious maintenance and labor-related troubles. Lorenzo says his application was in trouble because of union-led political pressure. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says President Clinton is right to limit American involvement in Bosnia. General John Shalikashvili has just returned from a trip to Europe, where he focused on the Balkan problem. Reports from the city of Garajda indicate that Bosnian Serbs are advancing on the town and burning homes in their path. Shalikashvili says Garajda isn't the same as Sarajevo, where the threat of NATO airstrikes forced Bosnian Serbs to stop attacking the city.
One of the things that we must consider is whether the use of air power will further the peace process. Secondly, whether the air power is the right instrument to use to bring the fighting to a halt or to reduce the fighting and thereby save the civilian population.
UN reports indicate Serbian troops have breached three defensive lines around Garajda. Peacekeeping Chief General Michael Rose is supposed to travel to the city tomorrow. Garajda is supposed to be one of the UN's declared safe zones. A new poll finds Americans are unhappy with the state of the country and worried about the future. And the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press says crime is on most people's minds. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Only one out of four people in the survey expressed satisfaction with the way things are going in the country. That's essentially unchanged from the attitude 6 months ago. About half of the people say they or someone in their family has either lost a job, taken a cut in pay or benefits, or works at a place where job cuts have occurred. On the other hand, Americans are fairly upbeat when they look at the situation closer to home. Two out of three people say they're satisfied with the way things are going in their neighborhoods, and even more say they're satisfied with their personal lives. According to the survey, the top five problems facing the country are crime, health care, jobs, drugs, and moral decline. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Southwestern Bell Corporation says it's calling off its nearly $5 billion cable partnership deal with Cox Cable Telecommunications. Southwestern is blaming the increased regulation of the cable industry. A Southwestern senior vice president says key issues in the decision included federal cable TV laws and a cable rate decrease ordered by the FCC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 81 points at 3,674. This is NPR. Los Angeles Dodger Darryl Strawberry won't be playing in any games soon. The Dodgers have put the outfielder on the disabled list. He is to receive treatment for substance abuse. Strawberry missed a Sunday exhibition game. Team officials and police searched for him all day. He was finally located Sunday evening at his home. The former Russian vice president has started a new campaign to get President Boris Yeltsin out of office. Alexander Rutskoy's move is seen as a new blow to a political truce. Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
Rutskoy's attack on Yeltsin appeared in the communist newspaper Pravda, and it was the toughest assault since he and others who led the bloody revolt last October were released from prison through a parliamentary amnesty last February. In the interview, Rutskoy accused Russia's rulers of being swindlers and political villains who ruined the economy and the armed forces and humiliated the great nation. Rutskoy's critique cannot help Yeltsin's current efforts to get Russia's political opponents to agree on his Memorandum of Civic Accord, which he hopes will end the power struggle and remove some of the obstacles to reforms. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
A survey finds that many American schools get good grades from parents, but the study says they could improve. The American Association of School Administrators conducted the survey. They found that parents want schools to get tough on troublemakers, cut overcrowding, and involve parents. The survey also found that public school parents tend to grade their own schools better than schools generally. The government says its chief forecasting gauge has fallen slightly for the first time in 7 months. The index of leading economic indicators dipped a slight 0.1% in February. The index is intended to predict economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. Analysts blame the slight decline on severe winter weather. They say the drops were led by the length of the manufacturing work week and a fall in building permits. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Sankofa is perhaps the first film about slavery in America made by an African. The writer, director, producer Haile Gerima is from Ethiopia. He came to the States in 1967 at the age of 21 to study at the Goodman School of Drama, and he decided to stay in America and make independent films. He describes his new film as addressing the problem of people in the African diaspora who neglect their own history. Sankofa begins on the coast of Ghana, where an African-American model is on a fashion shoot. She's oblivious to the fact that the castle behind her was used centuries ago to storehouse captured Africans about to be sent on slave ships to America. She enters the castle and is magically transported back into time and sent into slavery to learn her tragic history. Gerima is distributing the film himself. It's opened in several cities and opens in a Harlem theater on Friday. Gerima says that slavery wasn't taught in Ethiopian history classes. He learned about it in America. He told me about his early experiences as an African in America.
When I came in contact with African Americans, I was having a problem of identification. On one hand, I wanted to be different from them. On another hand, I continued to gravitate, or at least they continued to claim me as a brother. For example, in Chicago, I went to a drama school where there were only 4 black people. And as much as I tried to be different from other black people, the events, the racial turmoil, the period continued to push me or propel me towards the African-American community that embraced me, didn't look at me different.
And it's through the African-American community that you learned about slavery?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's that community and my association with it that forced me to really consider it as a serious event in Africa.
When you say that although African-Americans embraced you, you wanted to be different, in what way did you want to be different?
Well, by being an African, by being originally from Africa, but continually declaring I'm not part of this Americans that are not presented as people to aspire to be. Most economically, the status they have in America is not attractive, and you want to continue to disassociate with them to claim your Africanness, and so it was a major, at least on my case, being in theater, being in drama, being in the art and literature. It was a great deal of crisis that if you were trying out for a play, you would be cast as an African-American bum on a bench with the rest of the African-American actors. And here you're trying to say I'm different in the middle of all this racial text. And also the other point you have to know is I was not from economically advanced family. I had to come to America and do gardenings and work odd jobs, and in so doing, the discrimination, especially outside Illinois, doing gardenings and in Evanston, where I was located, also began to assault on me. The racial phenomena began to assault me, and so in doing some plays, even when I just came before I even knew anything, I began to write about the racist things that were happening to me. Mm-hmm. In so doing, I found identification with the racial struggle, or at least the African-American side of the struggle, I start to begin to shout like them. I start to get angry like them. I start to want to do a very violent act towards people.
I guess you could say that your new movie kind of brings together your experiences in Africa and in America. It's part of the movie takes place in America, part of it takes place in Africa.
Yeah.
And it's about the abduction of Africans to America for slavery.
Oh yeah, that's the primary genesis of the story. Is very, very personal and very displacement and memory. And I didn't just want to stage it contemporary. I just want to take it to the past because I felt that's where the battleground took place.
When your film opens, there's an African-American fashion model who's on a shoot in front of some of these slave fortresses on the Ghana coast. And she is, she's just there in high fashion clothes doing her shoot. But she's transported back into time after she enters one of these dungeons.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's transported back into time, she experiences what slavery was like. Is that the experience you want your audience to have, to be basically transported back in time through your film and to connect with a past that you hope they think about more deeply than they have?
Well, I felt, in most cases, the past was so significant in order to go forward. And so I would say, basically, my interest has always been history is where you exorcise most contemporary problems. And people, especially Africans and African-Americans, have never stopped for a second to pay tribute and cry and exorcise this turbulent and very genocidal historical event that took place in their lives, where they have equally participated in that event. And so, to me, the exorcising is a prerequisite in order to even go forward. And that, I realize now, at whatever level people are, come out still with that whole event being a sort of exorcising or a healing a platform.
It's interesting that you're using the words exorcising and healing. One would think that the emotion you would leave with after seeing a film on slavery is anger. But you're not talking about anger, you're talking about healing.
Every time my film shows, in most cases, we have somebody from the film crew present at the end of the film talking to people. In Baltimore, many young people are bused to see the film. We have 3, 4, 5 people who are instructors to talk to them and put everything in context. What we've seen so far is that most of them are saying, for example, a young man wrote me saying when he sees Hollywood films about slavery, he is always out angry and wanting to do something bad to people. And he says, seeing your film, I felt centered. I felt strengthened because I felt my people struggled and fought tooth and nail. And to me, I think that's the general response people have towards this film.
Because it emphasizes the struggle against slavery and
yeah,
rebellion?
Yeah, because what you have here is, in most cases, even within the Hollywood context, most attempts about slavery inherit the grammar of plantation interpretation of slavery, where Africans were devoted to be slave. They didn't complain. They were happy. They danced. Everything they did was presented from a plantation owner's perspective. And so what you have here is a film that says, the African race negated the whole idea of slavery from day one, and they fought to the best of their ability, tooth and nail. And I think that's a very important even point to raise, because most of the stories are polluted by making us dependent. Africans are always standing, waiting for Europeans to come, and then we just pick cotton or coffee or cut sugar for them, and life is for them. And we are just, we even sell ourselves in some movies to free masters who are in trouble with gambling. And this whole idea of false devotion that negates basic human notion wanting to be free and resisting slavery is a human notion. And the climate and the literature and this whole Hollywood cinema has always denied black people to make history, including contemporary movies like Mississippi Burning, where they are just in the outskirts of their own chapter, their own history.
A couple of the characters who you focus on in Sankofa are head slaves on the plantation. They're the slaves who've been assigned to be in charge of disciplining the other slaves, making sure they're working quick enough, whipping them sometimes as punishment. And you focus on these men as being in the position of both the tormented and the tormentor, and just the terrible predicament they're in. And I'm wondering what particularly drew you to their predicament.
You know, if you slavery cannot be left to the omnipotent power of Europeans, I think the participation of Africans as head slaves, slave drivers, is a very important point for me. As one of the principal characters who originates from Africa, Nunu, says, you know, the tormentor has always been, I mean, the head slave has always been my tormentor. And I think black people have always been betrayed by head slaves and certain representative translator figures, guides. And so in the story, that's part of the drama that takes place within the context of that experience.
I'm wondering, though, if you think that, like, the head slaves almost had no choice. I mean, it was to be in that position or be killed, probably.
No.
No, you think they rose to that position by...
Yes, by, you know, the compromise is basically also a human texture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's natural to compromise. But at the same time, there are also choices. For example, they could, the way it happened historically, some of them will be with the master in the daytime. At night, they'll be meeting the field hands to be part of the rebellion. I mean, Denmark Vesey's 1832, Nat Turner's, tells you these are head slaves that worked within the underground movement to develop the insurrection.
What kind of problems have you had getting your film Sankofa distributed nationally?
Most of the American distribution companies, from small to big, viewed the film and refused to show it. On the basis of saying that blacks will not go to this movie or Americans would not go to this movie.
Now, how do you interpret that? Because, I mean, your film is not exactly a commercial-looking movie in the way we think of mainstream films. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't look like a major motion picture in terms of the amount of money that you see on the screen, in terms of big-name actors, in terms of action. Do you know what I'm saying? It looks like an independent film.
You're right. From an ordinary point of view, that you can say that. But inside, when you fight inside the industry, as I do, I think even let's say we were that what you described. If we were white films, we would be given a chance to try the market, like Piano. Piano is not a commercial film, per se, from your explanation of what commercial is. Though I think commerce in America is race-based. The racial factor is very important. Try to take money to produce a movie. Try to go to the bank, ask for money to buy a house and be black. I think, to me, you know, commercialism is just a euphemism to hide most liberal racist people. And I think I have seen them act with sophisticated words where they tell you it's not commercial. And they, on the other hand, they open Orlando. They have opened many white filmmakers that I think are, in the definition you give, not commercial.
You know, it seems to me something you would be up against is a preconception that African-American audiences turn out more for films about the hood, or, you know, for action films.
But that's not true, because if you come in the audience, you'll see church people by bus coming in telling you in the audience they haven't been in movie house for 10, 15 years because they're tired of being insulted by that industry. They verbalize it to you like that. It's young, desperate kids who are making movies. But what about the simmered black people in Hollywood? They are always preempted by racism. They're never allowed to make film about their grandmother. Yet you'll see a white film about ordinary people. You'll see a film about piano. You'll see a film about crying games. And then the people bring this false marketing facts on you, because that's how racism is hiding now. But I want to say this to you. I think in this century, in the 21st century, black people are not going to anymore fight the dukes and the skinheads and Buchanans. Black people have to reconfigurate to ask liberals where they are now, where they stand from, and not take their research, their computerized facts as a fact. Racism is hiding in the closets of liberal people in Hollywood, in industries, radio stations. And so to me, this is what angers black people.
My guest is Haile Gerima, the writer, producer, and director of the new film Sankofa. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ethiopian-born filmmaker Haile Gerima. His new movie, Sankofa, is about slavery in America. As a filmmaker, you're a storyteller. You grew up in Ethiopia, and I know your father was a playwright there. And so I guess he was a storyteller, too. I mean, somebody
yes.
who...
Yeah.
Well, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about his work and what the role... What his role was in Ethiopian culture. I don't know if it's more of a written or an oral culture.
It's a written culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's the oldest written language. My father was educated on Ge'ez, which is the equivalent to the Latin in the European context.
Uh-huh.
And he comes up with a tradition of drama that has been handed down for a generation. And I worked on his plays as a young kid. I used to act. I was underneath this whole drama, not knowing in the sense that when I discovered cinema and Peace Corps and America, I didn't have value for my father's work. Though I was nurtured at an early stage, which is the saving grace I have now, I then began to be derailed and want to be just American.
You were educated through Peace Corps schools?
Yeah, I was the first generation of that whole Peace Corps program in Ethiopia.
So it was mostly American teachers?
American teachers. Was initially I had Indian or a British-designed school, but still at least I think the American culture, the films and the teachers gave us a different program whereby we just wanted to become like them.
What did it mean to you to become like them? What was the themness that that you tried to emulate?
To hate my background, to look down upon my grandmother's story, to go look at John Wayne and Indians, you know, and it miniaturized my culture, and I was culprit in making that happen. I'm not blaming anybody. Just that historical event just dislocated a whole generation, at least my generation, from an Ethiopian culture. All the traditional songs, all the traditional narratives, everything just was obliterated. And we entered just the cowboy and Indian world of American.
So what was your image of America from American movies? What were some of the movies that you really loved?
Well, mostly, really, at that stage, it is the shoot 'em out, you know, just the spectacle movies, the Audie Murphy movies, the John Wayne, Glenn Ford when they're killing Indians, or Tarzan when they were killing Africans. And
what was it like to see Tarzan movies in Ethiopia?
Well, it's funny. When I came to America, I was sitting around UCLA with African students who, all of them, we thought it happened in their area because none of us believed it happened in our section. So we were arguing it happened in Nigeria, and the Nigerian guy says, no, it happened in Kenya and the Ethiopian. So we know it didn't happen near us, but it was a point where we were on the side of Tarzan. You know, we were on the side of the cowboy against the Indians. And we will be whispering and shouting when they will approach or come and, you know, creep towards the Tarzan character or the John Wayne. We would be whistling to tell them they're coming at you.
So you came to America in part because you loved Hollywood films. You had this image of what America would be like from your Peace Corps teachers. But at some point, there must have been a big change in your attitude about what America represented and what your home in Ethiopia represented. Is there a certain turning point that you could describe?
Well, it was in Chicago at the Goodman School of Drama. I was on a play. I was sitting there. Here I am in Ethiopia. I came from Ethiopia. I'd played major parts and things. And here I was. I was here with African Americans as a bench bum. And we were watching as Romeo and Juliet, the white people in front of us. And this was, I start to realize there was most of the African-American actors were placed as just marginal excess things on the side. And I was having a hard time accepting this role. It no more became a play. The theater shows you the exclusion. You can't go try for Hamlet. You can't even dare, or at least even secretly aspire to even try out for Othello.
Although America is obviously not the thrilling place that you had hoped it would be, it must still have a real pull on you and be of great interest to you because you've continued to live here for about 25 years now. So what is it that keeps you in America?
Well, I would say, I have four kids and a wife. But there are many things that are from Tom Paine to Paul Robeson to Angela Davis, David Thoreau. There's many good things about America. But at the same time, I think the country does not know race is the most dangerous hydrogen bomb underneath this country that is not attended. That's the tragedy. And people who try to generate this as an agenda are always silenced. From Lenny Gunner to Kwame Ture to Angela Davis, people who are trying to raise the issue of race are silenced.
You're talking about being silent, and yet it seems that there are more books and films coming out by African Americans than ever before, and perhaps more discussion about race and the issues of race than there's been in a long time.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it looks like that, but I think even in publications, it's what's allowed to be published. I think you always have to know there are. If you see a Toni Morrison, then there's millions of Toni Morrisons that are not in. And I think the ratio, the proportion of neglecting so many voices, and also the selective process, who selects publications, who selects what movies to be made. When you see a white film, you see a rainbow from Piano to Schindler's List. You see a whole rainbow of films in between all the bad and good. In black films, it's one piece of meat, and that is what you have to go for. And over, you line up in movies, and black people are, like even in our films, what was very sad for me is that the fact very few white people dare to cross over to see my film. That was a sad awakening for me because I have always crossed over. And I think black people are big, very well-meaning crossover people to go see, line up so many movies that has no bearing to their even reality. So you see all these things. It gives you a different lesson. I don't think it's changed. I think it's getting worse, as far as I'm concerned.
Haile Gerima's new movie, Sankofa, is playing in Baltimore and opens Friday in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the so-called Butcher of Broadway moves to a new neighborhood. We talked to Frank Rich about his 13 years as the New York Times theater critic. His new position is writing op-ed columns for the Times. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album from soprano saxophonist Lowell Coxhill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Coast Guard says at least one crew member has died in the crash of a Navy plane into San Francisco Bay. A second is in extremely critical condition. Two Alameda Naval Air Station aviators ejected from the plane as they hit the water within sight of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. The Department of Transportation has denied Frank Lorenzo permission to start a new airline. Lorenzo is the former head of Continental and Eastern Airlines. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports.
Frank Lorenzo is the founder of ATX Airlines, a company which wanted to provide low-cost fares along the eastern seaboard. But Lorenzo's long past at the head of troubled airlines caught up with him. In rejecting his company's bid to fly, federal officials say Frank Lorenzo is not competent to run an airline and not inclined to follow safety rules. Lorenzo controlled Continental Airlines as it went into bankruptcy in the early 1980s and controlled Eastern in the late 80s as it suffered through safety violations and labor disputes and finally went out of business. When he voided union contracts at Continental, Lorenzo became an enemy of organized labor, and his company has claimed the rejection was a political vendetta by airline unions. ATX Airlines is expected to take the federal decision into court. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New York.
South African Zulus have defied a state of emergency in Natal province by carrying weapons at a march today. The emergency declaration bans weapons in the province. At least 61 people have died during the last 5 days in political violence. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Despite last week's ban on the public display of any weapons, Zulus arriving in the northern Natal town of Empangeni today brandished spears and clubs as they gathered under police observation. The march in Empangeni was called by the Zulu nationalist Inkatha Freedom Party, which is boycotting elections scheduled for the end of the month. Inkatha's resistance revived its long-running war with the rival African National Congress and provoked last week's state of emergency declaration. But the deployment of several hundred army troops over the weekend has not yet slowed the carnage. On Friday, Zulu nationalist leaders meet ANC and government representatives to seek a negotiated peace in Natal. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
A Russian government commission has confirmed reports that a Russian airliner crashed last month in Siberia because the pilot's children were in the cockpit. All 75 people aboard died. The officials say the pilot and other crew members were demonstrating how to fly the plane when it veered off course and crashed. On Wall Street today, stock prices have roared back from yesterday's low. The Dow gained more than 82 points to end the day at 3,675.41. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 7-1. This is NPR. Authorities in Columbus, Georgia, say a gasoline spill in the city's sewer system has released dangerously high levels of fumes. Officials are warning that a spark could trigger an explosion and a major fire. Nearly 90 businesses and homes have been evacuated since officials discovered the problem yesterday. Power and natural gas services have been cut off. Hazardous materials teams are going from building to locate the leak. They ventilated the sewer system by removing manhole covers and adding carbon dioxide. The government is recalling 11 brands of crayons because they have lead in them. The crayons are imported from China. NPR's Melinda Penkava reports.
The chairman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission says the crayons should be taken back to the store or thrown away. Ann Brown says three brands in particular have so much lead in them they can give lead poisoning to a child who might eat or chew on them. Lead is especially hazardous to children. It can cause them irreversible brain damage. Those Chinese crayons were distributed by Concord Enterprises, Glory Stationery, and the Toys R Us chain. The other eight brands did not have as much lead in them, but the CSPC warns that eating those crayons over time could increase a child's lead load. Crayons that have been tested for lead have a label that reads, "Conforms to ASTM-D 4236. However, the CSPC says the Glory Stationery brand also carried that label, along with hazardous levels of lead. I'm Melinda Pencava in Washington.
PLO and Israeli negotiators are working on details of the Palestinian police force. Senior Palestinian officers were expected to go into the occupied territories by now. They're supposed to prepare for an advance unit of several hundred police later this week, but both actions have been held up by disputes at the bargaining table. A senior PLO negotiator says the disputes are on the timing and the weapons distribution. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Frank Rich doesn't think he quite earned the nickname the Butcher of Broadway, but his reviews were said to have the power to make or break a show. For 13 years, he was the chief theater critic for the New York Times. At the beginning of the year, he left the theater beat to write an op-ed column which appears twice weekly in the Times. His column seems to have really caught on. He's written about America's infatuation with celebrity, clashes between blacks and Jews, the hyping of Nancy Kerrigan, and what it's like being a healthy heterosexual in the company of a gay man dying of AIDS. I asked Frank Rich what he thinks of as his new beat.
Well, the great thing about this job is that I don't really have a beat per se. I think there was some idea at the beginning, which is still held to, that I would be looking at that intersection between culture and the news, but not in any kind of dogmatic way, and, you know, not just looking at direct reflections, but I can do things that are more eccentric and go really wherever my mind takes me.
The assumption was during the years that you were the first string critic that you could either kill a show or make it into a huge success. And I'm wondering how true you think that was and whether the thought of that possibility would weigh on you as you were writing your review, or if that's something you tried not to think about.
Well, first of all, it's part of the mythology of the job. And it was true before I was a Times drama critic. It was true when there were seven newspapers in New York when I was a kid. Times drama critic is always considered to have this make or break power. It's extremely exaggerated. Of course, occasionally a Times review can make a big difference, pro or con, and there were a couple of examples, but not many during my 13 years. But usually, the shows that are the big hits in New York, that reflects a consensus of opinion. People could say, oh, New York Times, Frank Rich made Guys and Dolls a hit, or made Tommy a hit, or Angels in America a hit. In fact, they got unanimously favorable reviews, or close to it, from all the major newspapers and magazines. So why would the Times be entirely responsible? And the same thing's true with the flops. However, in doing the job, to answer your second question, I always tuned it out because, frankly, as a journalist, that was none of my business. My business was to tell the reader as honestly as I could what I felt about something, and that's who I had in mind, the reader who might have to spend $50 or $100 to see one of these plays and spend an evening there. My heart was with the reader.
When you were reviewing theater, were you self-conscious about that moment when you'd walk into the theater and walk down the aisle, and people were probably turning to each other and saying, "It's Frank Rich, the Times theater critic"?
Not terribly. First of all, I don't think I was so recognized until maybe the last couple of years when I started to be more on TV and stuff like that. But I learned to tune it out. It wasn't part of my job. Even when I was fairly unknown, I always knew that the people were planted around me to scream and yell in my ear and say things like, "Gosh, isn't that the greatest performance you've ever seen in your life?" You know, 1 minute after it began.
Were they really planted there?
They really were planted there. I'll never forget taking one of my two sons, who was then quite young, he probably was 9 or 10 years old, to an incredibly dreadful murder mystery that shall remain nameless. It was the first time he came with me when I was reviewing something, and we went to a matinee, and it was supposed to be this funny murder mystery, and it was completely unfunny, and also you could figure out who did it about 15 minutes into the show. Well, behind us, there are a couple of men, I'd say, in their early 60s, who are just slapping their legs and screaming with laughter at every silly line. And afterwards, as we're leaving the theater, my son turns to me, and he was this little kid. He says, "Dad, what was going on? Why were those people laughing so much?" And I said, "Well, they were planted there by the management. They're trying to influence the opinion of critics like me." And he said, "But, Dad, they were grown-ups. I can't believe they did that." So that kind of stuff goes on all the time. And you just learn to tune it out. Similarly, there's a converse to that, which is that sometimes through happenstance, a show postponing its opening several times in such a way that they're letting the critics in at a date they hadn't originally planned on, and the audience, unfortunately for them, in their view, is filled with real people who are not necessarily part of a claque, that audience can be very hostile to a show that you find yourself liking. And you've got to fight the impulse to be influenced by that, too. A classic example is a show where I feel I did make a difference, Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George. That show postponed so often, by the time the critics went, they had no choice but to let us go on a theater party night where the audience was very jaded, somewhat elderly, very suburban. It's a very daring show, and there were lots of walkouts and lots of hostile response and tepid response. And yet I was sitting there crying. I was so moved by the show. And so I had learned to tune out that, just as I learned to tune out the false cheers of shows that were not so good.
My guest is Frank Rich. He's the former New York Times theater critic and now writes a column for the Op-Ed page. I'm going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Frank Rich, former New York Times theater critic, currently op-ed columnist for The Times. The producer, David Merrick, was alleged to have said about you, "Mr. Rich made many contributions to the American theater, none more great than to leave his post as theater critic." What was between you and David Merrick that would lead him to say such a thing, or to at least have been reputed to say such a thing?
Not much, really. The absence of people like David Merrick is really one thing that's hurt the theater very badly. I'm a David Merrick fan. I grew up in his heyday, which had passed really by the time I became a drama critic. There were only a couple of shows that he did during the 13 years I was there. He always had vendettas against the New York Times drama critic, and he would use them to sell his shows. And this was less the case when I was critic, but it was brilliant when I was growing up. You know, he did famous stunts such as take out ads with fake quotes by critics who had the same names as the New York Times drama critics. He baited one of my predecessors by attacking him on the Johnny Carson show for a half hour. Another one, he had distributed his Christmas gift of a supposedly pornographic novel that this critic had written as a young man and was thought to have vanished from the face of the earth. Merrick found every copy, like in a Paris bookstore, and gave it to the entire New York press corps. He was a great showman, and the truth is that I didn't know him, and my fondest memories of him are as a teenager. I took tickets for a lot of his shows, and I thought that was the theater, what the Broadway theater should be. Not that he couldn't be a jerk, and he was, you know, a mean guy, I'm sure, but nonetheless, he did incredible stuff, from, you know, Look Back in Anger and Marat Sade at one extreme to Gypsy and Hello Dolly at the other. I only had him in the tail end of career, and he said that about me because I'm sure I didn't like 42nd Street enough, which is one of the first shows I reviewed and one of the last shows, sadly, that he produced.
There were a couple of almost legendary feuds that you got in during the years that you were theater critic. Without really going into them, I'll say that the things that were said about you include that that there was a personal nastiness sometimes behind what you wrote, and another comment was that you had strongly influenced not only the aesthetic direction of theater, but the artistic personnel, the style and content of American theater. How would you respond to both of those things? We'll start first with personal nastiness.
The first thing is easy. I'm not saying that I couldn't be tough, and I could certainly be a very tart writer. I hope I was. But there was nothing personal going on because I didn't know the people I was reviewing. One of the things that that's important to the Times about any of its drama critics or critics in general is that we don't know the people we're reviewing. I didn't go to the Tony Awards. I didn't know David Merrick personally or someone, say, like David Hare, to give an example of someone who took a strong exception to what I wrote about some of his work, although I liked a lot of it. I didn't know David Hare. So, I don't know, I think that's what's always said about bad reviews, no matter who writes them. As far as influencing artistic trends in the theater, I think artists are very independent people and do not, good artists don't write what critics or journalists or anyone, or their parents or their spouses or their loved ones tell them to write. I do feel, and I'm proud of the fact, that I champion certain kinds of theater while I was a drama critic. I had a very strong point of view, and, you know, I'm very much stand behind it. And it is true that probably because I extravagantly praised Tony Kushner's Angels in America, to take a handy and recent example, when it was being done in a very small theater, a very small stage, the National Theater in London, it probably did influence the decision of Broadway producers to take a chance on it and bring it to New York at no doubt huge cost, given the length and kind of play it is. Yet, I'm fine about that. I think that art like that needs advocacy, and frankly, I think that if I was the only one who felt that way about Angels in America, it would have failed. And it hasn't failed because obviously it rings a chord with a lot of people. And there are other things I didn't champion. I was not a fan of the musicals of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And
well, you had a lot of influence there.
I had exactly zero influence, exactly. But, you know, but here's an example of someone who every time I knocked one of his shows, and I didn't knock all of them, and I didn't knock them uniformly, would give out an interview and saying it was a personal attack on him or whatever. I've never met Andrew Lloyd Webber, I just know what I see and hear, and I also, again, as you said, I had no effect there. That's fine, too. I think that the public has to be given credit for knowing its own mind, and if people want Phantom of the Opera, they're going to find it, and they're going to embrace it, even if the New York Times critic doesn't like it, which I didn't much.
Just a little sidebar here. When you and the playwright David Hare were disagreeing, Variety had the headline. This was after you had given a bad review to The Secret Rapture and then
right.
It closed. Variety had the headline, Hare airs rich bitch, writer of El Foldo, Rapture, lashes out at New York Times powerful legit critic. I thought, wow.
Well,
what a headline.
I thought it was great. I'm very proud to have had it. I just say two things about that. First of all, it shows how crazy the theater business is. In fact, if you just knew that one incident, you'd think that I had been the sworn enemy of David Hare's writing, when in fact I'd probably been the biggest champion of all of his writing of any critic in America, including, by the way, The Secret Rapture. I just thought it was produced poorly in New York.
You liked the London production.
I liked the London production, but I love the play. The other sidelight about that headline is that Variety doesn't have headlines like that anymore, you know, like Wall Street Lays an Egg and Hicks, Nicks, Sticks, Picks, because of the internationalization, if that's a word, of show business, Variety has sort of stamped out Variety ease. It's now written so it can be understood by the German and the Japanese showbiz mogul, like the Hollywood and Broadway producer. And so they're just really, you don't see headlines like that anymore. So I'm touched that I was the subject of one of the very last ones, if not the last.
I want to ask you a question about reading your own emotions when you're watching theater, television, movies, whatever. Do you ever, for example, find your eyes misting up, and at the same time you're going to go out there and give something a bad review because you don't trust those tears in your eyes? You don't trust the way you're being manipulated by what you're watching?
Generally speaking, no. I feel that you have to go with your instincts. You have to know where those feelings are coming from. Sure, there's sometimes when you can be really, really manipulated, you know, at the end of a schlocky movie, hypothetically.
Even some TV commercials.
Even some TV commercials, you know. Some of those AT&T commercials are pretty touching. But you have to know yourself, and you have to know the difference between that and being profoundly moved when Steven Spinella waves goodbye at the end of Perestroika or any of a million of other examples I could name. And I think, you know, you have to be ruthless with yourself. But my tendency always is to go with my instinct. If I'm crying, it's probably because it's moving, and or at least I find it really moving. I'm not being manipulated. And if I'm laughing, it may be because it's really funny. And it also, maybe if I'm yawning, it may not be because I'm tired. It may be because the play is boring. Walter Kerr, a predecessor of mine who I got to know in later years and sort of an idol of mine when I was learning about drama criticism when I was younger, said to me once, you know, if you think you're sick in the theater, it never is that you're sick. Something is happening on stage. It's making you feel sick. And I thought that was sort of good advice. You have to trust yourself and, you know, have a good sense of who you are and how sometimes your buttons can be pushed for the wrong reasons. But go with it and not be afraid to feel. The greatest thing about theater going is to go there, you know, open to the experience. And who would want to go if you can't do that? You don't go there as a critic, so self-conscious and so conscious of giving grades and different standards that have to be met that you can't have an emotional response. You've got to go there in the same way that you went there as a child, the way I fell in love with theater as a child, which is feeling that curtain's going to go up and anything could happen and I could be, you know, moved to tears or I could be excited or my ideas about some subject could change profoundly because of what's going to happen on that stage. But I don't know what's going to happen until it happens, and I've got to be there, really there and part of the experience and ready for it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Frank Rich is the former chief theater critic for the New York Times. His new op-ed column is published twice weekly in the Times. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, I imagine you're trying to interpret the numbers in the stock market today.
Right. We're actually trying to interpret what any of this means, taking a look at stocks, bonds, and mutual funds and see what it might mean for any of those kinds of investments. Also, a survey done by the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press on the American mood. This was a survey done in conjunction with NPR, finds the American people feeling good about their own health and about their own situation, but not so good about their government. Also, Frank Lorenzo, who used to own Eastern, cannot have another airline, says the government.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. That's the English soprano saxophonist Lowell Coxhill. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says when he reviewed solo saxophonist Evan Parker on the show last fall, he was surprised and pleased by the positive response. So he thought he'd tempt fate today by introducing us to another of his favorite musicians that few people have heard of. Thank you.
late 60s and early 70s was the boom period for unaccompanied jazz saxophone. Coleman Hawkins and Eric Dolphy had recorded a few solo pieces earlier, but suddenly a handful of saxophonists were playing alone in public. Anthony Braxton, Roscoe Mitchell, Evan Parker, Steve Lacy, and Lowell Coxhill. A soft-spoken and imposing man of 61, he plays the way the Pied Piper of Hamelin might if he'd had a saxophone. Coxhill also works as an actor. He turned up in the film Orlando and has recorded as a crooning ballad singer and as a musical satirist with the trio The Melody Four. I like that stuff, but his solo work is the most distinctive, partly for the way he bends notes, sliding around like a trombonist. That's Lowell Coxhill on the CD The Dunois Solos on the French label Nato. Everything about Coxhill's soprano sax playing is slippery, not just his sense of pitch. As he bends notes, he also adjusts the density or purity of his tone. He lets the volume swell up or down and lets the beat expand or contract. Like Evan Parker, he'll instantly create a musical space unlike anyone else's, a space in which all the laws are consistent. No matter how radical it may sound, no musical style drops out of the sky like the stork brought it. Lowell Coxhill's main inspiration was the eccentric clarinetist Pee Wee Russell. You can hear the slinky alto sax of Johnny Hodges in there, too. So yes, Coxhill has those all-important jazz roots, but you know, those jazz roots aren't really that important. These days, you can't play jazz or klezmer or polka without debating how authentic it is. But what's really important is that such labels not be used to ignore good music that doesn't fit established categories. Is this music jazz? I don't know. Depends on when you ask me. Is it good? Every time.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead writes for Downbeat, CD Review, Coda, and The Village Voice. He reviewed the Dunois solos on the French label Nato, featuring the English saxophonist Lowell Coxhill. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Dorothy Farabee, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
North Korea is threatening war. On the next Fresh Air, what does North Korea really want, and what's at stake for the region and America? I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.